From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Bob Geldof, the Irish rock singer who organized the Live Aid concert for famine relief and argued with Mother Teresa over the meaning of Africa's suffering. Also today, our rock critic Ken Tucker confesses what he was doing before he started getting paid for what he does. It's another in our series of interviews with Fresh Air's contributors. Ken also has a review of records by Rick Astley and his sister Virginia. Rick Astley has the top hit in England, and the song is now getting wide airplay on American stations. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Unbearable Lightness of Being, based on the popular 1984 novel. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Bob Geldof was the leader of the Irish rock group The Boomtown Rats when in 1984 he saw a TV report about the famine in Ethiopia. He says he wanted to send money, but he thought that wasn't enough. But he asked himself what else could he do. He thought of himself as a not very successful pop singer who could only make records that no one bought. Even so, he thought he'd make the gesture of donating the profits of his next record to Food for Ethiopia. Then he got a better idea, to organize some of Britain's biggest rock stars to record a song together and donate the profits. That group effort became known as Band Aid. Their single, Do They Know It's Christmas, became the best-selling single of all time in England. That led Geldof to organize the international benefit concert Live Aid. It was held in July 1985. All told, his efforts have raised $140 million. Geldof was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize, won the United Nations World Hunger Media Award, and was knighted by the Queen of England. But he was also criticized for not featuring many black performers in the Live Aid concert, and questions have been raised about how he has managed the money. In the interim, Geldof's band, the Boomtown Rats, has broken up, and he's embarked on a solo career. He's also written an autobiography titled Is That It?, and it's just been published in paperback. He's joining us today from the NPR Bureau in New York. Before we meet him, this is Geldof singing with the Boomtown Rats. Bob Geldof, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let's talk about Live Aid a little bit. I got the impression from the end of your book that you were kind of anxious to leave in a way and to start on whatever your next project will be. Is that right?
It's not that I was so much anxious to leave that behind me. It's that the whole point about Band Aid was that it should have built-in obsolescence because I never wanted it to be an institution. I never wanted it to repeat what Oxfam or CARE or Save the Children do admirably. It was supposed to be an expression of anger, and had it continued, it would have lost that sense of immediacy and possibility that perhaps it had. As it stands now, it still exists, and I'm still chairman of it. And we have about $22 million left to spend from the total. Thank God, because the situation is increasingly bad over there again.
What's the money primarily being used for now?
Primarily, it's on long-term development projects, which can range from massive dams to tiny little holes in the sand that gather up water and you cover with a tarpaulin canvas. It ranges through mainly agricultural projects, irrigation, reforestation, terracing, soil rehabilitation, orphanages, trucking. We have 622 wheelers there. Emergency aid, medicine, food, house, shelter, that sort of thing.
Is using money to help end a famine more difficult than you thought it was going to be when you started this project?
No, not at all. I mean, it will not end the famine. Which is why the pun in the first place, a band-aid on a gaping wound, it's not possible to solve it. It was to be, an expression of compassion and anger and possibility. Famine is a political problem. It is not an environmental problem.
Were you ever afraid when you realized how much money you were going to get from Live Aid? It's quite a responsibility to oversee that much money.
Well, I mean, I constantly underestimate. I'm useless at that sort of thing. I thought the Band-Aid record was going to make £70,000, and £8 million later, I was a bit overwhelmed. And then Live Aid, I remember saying to the trustees, I said, I estimate about £10 million. And then when we got £10 million alone from one sponsorship company, I didn't know what the hell would happen, you know. So, no, not really. It's not that. I mean, what happens is that the actual physical requirements of accepting that money from all over the world is difficult. You have to talk to practically every banking system literally on the planet, every post office in the planet. The last call I made before going to bed the night before Live Aid was to the Norwegian Postmaster General. And it was that sort of mundane thing that people don't think about. They think, hey, pop stars, you know, and stuff like that. But in fact, I was talking to more bankers and postmasters to make sure the post offices were able to receive money and things. And when you're dealing with people in Nepal and New Caledonia, it's difficult.
In your book, you describe that during the peak of Live Aid, that you were hit with the God syndrome, that a lot of people saw you as being saintly. What's the God syndrome? Describe that.
It's been approached with the moist eye to touch the hem of the garment, you know. It's very irritating.
Well, from the way you describe it, you would greet people with expletives who you that way.
If I was angered by it, you know, I mean, I was angered that people... I mean, I got the cranks as well, people writing to me telling me I was one of the 12. 12 what? What are they talking about? Or one of the 9? 9 what, you know? I mean, and it was the same thing. It was as preposterous, you know. I dislike it very much, you know, and that people, like, I mean, some people would come over and say, I remember a vicar saying to me, if Christ was here, he'd be with you, you know, or some nonsense like this. And, you know, it just irritated me that they would always remove it from human experience and somehow make it divine. And I that irritated me profoundly. I met Mother Teresa, and she was an absolutely startling person. I mean, without doubt, the most incredible person I've ever met. And but she said to me that she saw the suffering of Christ. We were both in Addis, I think, at the time, in these people. And that irritated me a lot. And I had a big argument with her about her, because I said to me, it's a denial of God if you believe in God, and I'm quite iffy on the subject. It seemed to me to be a complete denial of that being. I mean, if you are of the Judeo-Christian, a tradition, then you believe that God gave us free will, and in so doing, then we must choose to allow these things to exist, and God must spit in our eye that we do.
As much as you really hated being thought of as saintly, did you ever have to wrestle with a Superman problem yourself? I mean, having gotten that much money, having organized such a big event and gotten so many awards and international publicity, did it have any bad effects on your own ego, which could really get pretty inflated after pulling off such an event?
So Americans are obsessed by ego. They always ask me about pop stars' egos, and was that not the main problem? I mean, Postmaster Generals have bigger egos than pop stars. I don't think ego's certainly not a problem for me, because, you see, it was just an organic thing. It grew on a day-to-day basis. There was a problem, like, for example, how the hell do we collect this money? So you went and found out about it and then did something about it. And I think viewed from outside, you know, you see this person doing this sort of thing, and you think, gosh, that's great. And, I wish we were all like that sort of thing. And, of course, the point about Band-Aid was that anybody could have done it. And certainly, I'm not sure about here, but in Britain, I remember saying that this situation is not about charity, it's about a moral imperative. the imperative that you must do something or else you're guilty of complicity to murder, because we saw it on our TV screens. We had the means to stop it. And if we didn't stop it, how guilty are we then, all of us? And so no matter what it is you do, yes, send money, but more important, give something of yourself. And I don't know what you're capable of doing, but you're capable of doing something. And as a result, you had secretary aid and town planners aid. I mean, God knows what the town planners did, but they did something using their own skill. And that's what I was doing. I was using what I had, i.e. the ability to write songs, the ability to play them, and the ability to have access to the media.
Bob Geldof is my guest. He organized Live Aid and Band Aid, and his autobiography, Is That It?, has just been published in paperback. It seems to me that you really saw, in a way, that the best and also the most exploitative parts of people while organizing Live Aid. You saw the best in that people were really willing to make a lot of personal sacrifices and give a lot of their time, their intelligence, and their money as well. Mm. On the other hand, you saw people really wanting to exploit the heck out of this effort and have their logo near your logo and jockey for the best airtime and, you know, use it for commercial reasons and self-promotion and so on. Where did you draw the line in where you didn't want? I know people had to get something out of it in order to participate, but was there a line that you would draw where you'd say, no, this is just exploitation? You can't use your logo with ours, or you're not going to get this prime time or whatever?
Well, I dispute you there. I don't think maybe 0.3% of people wanted to get anything out of it. Certainly none of the bands, with the exception of two or three, ever bothered me about where their position on the bill was or anything like that. And subsequent to Live Aid, you know, people were saying, huh, you know, and I suppose they sold lots of records. I can absolutely categorically state that I doubt if any band, I mean, are you kidding me? Do you think David Bowie needs any more publicity than he's got, you know, or needs to sell any more records than he already has? That wasn't a question. Where people wanted to get something, I guess, was in commercial sponsorship. But I would view that simply as a business transaction. I had to try and screw as much out of them as I possibly could. And I was prepared to do anything. I mean, I remember a phone call. Pepsi, as they say in America, came on board very early on, and Coke were really miffed. But they had their opportunity, and they rang me one Sunday from Atlanta when I was at home watching telly. And they said, look, Bob, you know, we really want to get something here. And I said, I'm sorry, but we've already sold the logo sort of thing to Pepsi. And they said, well, is there anything else? And I invented on the spot the term the global jukebox and told them that I had a logo for this. And they asked, could they buy that? And I had somebody knock up a global jukebox that afternoon and faxed it over to Atlanta. So, you know, I mean, who's exploiting who? I would take anybody that I possibly could in order to help those people. And I think I was morally justified in doing that. As for them being able to take me, it was only a question of how far you perceive that they were exploiting you. And as I say, at one point, part of the book, the record industry is fine if you go into it with the basis of you scratch my back and I'll claw yours. And it's just a question of who's got the sharper fingernails. With regard to bands jockeying for position, that happened with only one or two people.
We know what I want to ask you about bands. I'm sure there were a lot of bands who wanted to be on Live Aid who you really didn't want to be on because you could get better bands.
No, it wasn't a question of better bands. To me, again, it came down to everything was pragmatic. It wasn't a question of personal choice.
But here's what I mean. What would you tell a band who wanted to be on, who was really willing to give of their time and effort, but you really didn't want them on the bill? How would you handle that?
It wasn't that I didn't want them. I would simply say you don't sell as many records as Joe Blow. And that's it. And if you sell 10,000 records and you're a great band and this guy sells 10 million... I'll take the 10 million, because if 10% of that 10 million would give money, it's better than 10% of the 10,000.
You said before that you didn't think that any of the bands really got the kind of publicity that helped them sell more records from this, or that they needed that kind of publicity.
They probably got the publicity, but they didn't need it. That was the least motivation. In fact, look, I'm fed up with people going on about bands. They are, by and large, the most intelligent group of people that you could possibly work with. They have less ego, because their ego is constantly flattered by playing live, than, say, well, radio journalists, for example, or bankers, or stuff like that. So this sort of base motivation that people somehow consider the world of pop to be plastic and artificial is nonsense. It is not. And nor are they.
So you think too much is being made of this?
I think that it's always people who don't understand in pop music.
Let me ask you one question that you're really going to hate. Okay. Your band never had quite caught on in America, the Boomtown Rats.
Yeah, right.
And your records, you know, solo and with the band, never really caught on in America like it did in Europe.
Mm.
How did all the attention of Live Aid affect your own recording career?
In a negative sense, as you said, my solo career hasn't really exploded with the fireworks one would have desired. But in a negative sense, because people constantly ask me about Live Aid, which is fair enough. And then in the sense that if you go into a rock radio station with my record, they'll scrutinize it lyrically. And then they'll put on the record and say, hey, here's Bob Geldof, a really great guy. You know, we all owe him one. Let's play his record. As if, you know, they're doing me a big favor by playing my record. Look, play my record if you like it. Don't play it if you don't like it. But don't think you're doing me favors. The net result is that if they play a record and it doesn't sell, when I come in with the second record, they say, hey, come on, Bob, we've done you a favor, you know. It's as if I'm sort of some sort of dilettante pop singer. In fact, that's how I pay my electricity bills. And I've been playing pop music since 1975. In fact, the music is a byproduct of the way I think. And Band Aid was only a byproduct of that music.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your musical career, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Bob Geldof, who organized Live Aid and Band Aid and is the author of an autobiography titled Is That It?, which has just been published in paperback. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Bob Geldof is my guest. I want to talk with you a little bit about growing up in Ireland and getting your band organized there. You write in your autobiography that you hated being a teenager, you longed to be 20, and you said, now life at 20 could begin. The 60s were dying, and I was delighted. Why did you hate being a teenager and also hate the 60s?
The 60s were very indulgent and maybe necessary, but in retrospect, a little silly. And a lot of their values were, I thought at the time, naive, and I still think, with the ever-increasing rejection of those values, a little wrong. And I hated being a teenager because I think it's an intensely tedious time anyway. You live your life in almost a permanent state of not only physical confusion, but also mental confusion, and you're equipped with all the faculties to be able to operate on this planet, but in fact you can't use them, and you know your sexuality is confused. You still must conform to school and home and all those things, and that was okay, but I wasn't having a very pleasant life anyway.
Well, you say something, you mentioned sex, you said something that I thought was very, very funny. You spent a lot of time in your early teens masturbating, and you said you were afraid you were going to use up your quota of orgasms, and I thought to myself, how many people really thought this when they were young, before they knew what was what?
Yeah, well, I mean, Hemingway thought it all through his life, you know, but it's... yeah, I did. I mean, obviously, everybody masturbates a lot, I think, when they're a teenager. Everybody seems to have picked up on this fact in the book, incidentally.
Oh, really?
especially guys, they always go, huh, God, Bob, you know, they talk a lot about masturbating. In fact, they use, you know, other terms as I do. But and the funny thing is that they all pretend they don't do it now. You know, I grew out of that when I was 18, you know. Grew out of what? It's great fun, you know. I mean, what do you want to grow out of it for? And it's, you know, like, they'd all go, and I'd say, well, of course, you know. They'd say, like, well, do you still do it? And I'd say, yeah, when I feel like it, you know.
Well, another thing I noticed in your autobiography is that you have a real gift for organization and for getting attention.
Yes.
But you also have a real gift for really alienating people, for being so outspoken as to be really rude and nasty. For instance, you were on the Irish Late Late Show. I've never seen the show, obviously, but I guess there's a lot of bands that are on.
No, it's like talk the talk show. Yeah.
Oh, like the Tonight Show or something?
A little more serious than the Tonight Show. It takes into account issues and those sort of things rather than... well, it does take into account a show like this, say a book plugging type affair.
Right. So you're on the show and you're talking about how much you hate Dublin and how your father used to beat you, and of course your father was watching. I really wondered. This is before you were
known.
Yeah. And
it was a very.
I wondered what got into you to say all of that on television.
A lot got into me. My background got into me. It was my first revenge. And I seized it. You talked originally about my organisational sense. Because my mum died when I was six or so, and my older sister had cancer and was given a year to live in the same year, my father was away all week except at weekends. And so he was completely distraught, and he had no money. And my sister went away to Lourdes, which is a Catholic religious shrine in France, and came back cured, miraculous, our mental power. It doesn't matter. But so he was off doing this thing and was like, really caught up in that. And so I was left to my own devices. And you start to organise your life because you have to. And at the age of eight, you have to make sure that there's enough food in to eat, and you have to make sure you order the coal for the fire because Dublin is a damp city. And so you learn to organise yourself. You also learn very quickly self-sufficiency and independence. And what happens is that when you have independent action, independent thought follows quickly. And so not only do you have an organisational capacity, but you begin to articulate things you believe. And if anybody then tries to temper that opinion, which would normally happen in a normal household, your parents or your brothers and sisters would temper your opinion. In my household, that didn't happen, so I became dogmatic. And the organisational sense manifested itself early in only the two things that interested me, politics and music. I wasn't interested in sport. And I organised the campaign for nuclear disarmament and joined anti-apartheid at 14. And so, because my father was away except at the weekends, this man was a stranger to me, and because I was independent, he would try and discipline me. And so he beat me a lot, and in school I was beaten every day at least once. And so when the time came to run out of those gates and out of the door of my house, I did so. And at the moment where I could exact revenge, it was a very public revenge. It meant finally I had a platform to talk about the things that bothered me, and it was on television and on the major network show, and I exacted that revenge.
Bob Geldof is my guest, the organizer of Live Aid and Band Aid, and he's written a new autobiography titled Is That It? Tell me if this is an apocryphal story or not. A friend of mine who used to manage a record store told me that when one of your Boomtown Rats records came out in America, that there was a promotional campaign for the record in which dead rats were sent out. Is that true?
Yes, unfortunately, yes it is.
Whose idea was that?
It was the record companies at the time. They thought this would be hip.
And was it?
No. I mean, it was like the rats were in plastic formaldehyde, you know, so they were preserved and stuff like that, you know, in this plastic bag. And it was 1977, which was sort of the apogee of the new wave punk thing. And they thought that this was sort of the American way of getting this launched. And, of course, I think they misunderstood the whole thing violently. I think they misunderstood it. The whole New Wave thing was about reassessing those attitudes of selfishness which were the result of the 60s self-indulgence, the selfishness of the 70s. And pop music reflected that with a sort of limousine lifestyle. And all the bands in Britain that were operating this new type of ethic rejected that utterly, and it was about that. It was about reevaluating pop music and questioning where it was going and trying to pull it back onto the rails, which worked.
Did you want to stop the company from sending out these dead rats as a promotional gimmick?
To be honest, I didn't know about it, but whether I had have known about it or not, I don't know whether I would have stopped it or not. I don't know whether I'd have thought at the time, this is neat, this will upset people, or this will make them, jolt a bit sitting behind their desk deciding what records they'll play and what they won't play. But it did hurt us in terms of our career, yes.
I think it might have hurt you on two levels. One is that some people would have been offended to get the dead rats. And the other is I think some people thought it really rang false to have like a record company sending out the dead rats, being, you know, living,
yes,
trying to come off as so like daring and,
yes,
and avant-garde.
I think they're right, you know. I mean, as John Lennon said, avant-garde is the French for bullshit.
You know, you've had this obsession, I think, through your life with being exposed to extremes. You describe going to South Asia for the first time and just really shopping for extremes, to see something as extreme as in The Deer Hunter. And what you got exposed to was a kind of bizarre sexual display, really.
It isn't that I'm obsessed with extremes. It's that I want to experience things in order that I may question my own feeling towards them. And if you've read the book, then I gather you'll have got that from it, I hope. It is a sort of act of moral cowardice, I suppose, ultimately. It is vicarious through. But it goes beyond that to a certain degree, because I do want to find out what certain things are like. And also it comes down to the plain fact that I at one point say in the book that the only real sin is wasting time. And I absolutely agree with that, that's for me an absolute truism. You have 70 years, possibly, if you're lucky, in this life. And out of all infinity, that seems to me to be a bit of a raw deal, in which case, why waste a second of it? And try and do everything you're capable of, which is less than some people and more than others, without hurting anybody. And that, to me, would be what I would imagine life has got to be about.
Well, the extreme that you were exposed to that moved you the most and changed your life the most was obviously the Ethiopian famine.
It wasn't the extreme, the worst extreme, to be honest, I've been exposed to, but it was the one that probably had the most ultimately profound effect on my life, willy-nilly.
So how has that changed your interest in looking for extremes? I mean, because this was not just a kind of like freak show extreme for you. Do you know what I mean? This
yes,
was something
exactly.
You really sank your life into.
It was by accident that my life got caught up in it, because I had reacted to it, as I said to you earlier in the interview, by saying, well, this demands something of myself. It's nothing to do with charity. It's to do with moral imperative and intellectual absurdity. And in the end, it became, no matter what way you looked at it, a source of human shame. And more than anything, that's the thing that irritated me. And so I set out to do something about it. And consequently, I did see things and was involved in things that no human being should ever have to see.
What's happening with your performance career now? Are you going to continue to record and perform?
Yes, I've just, last night I flew in from Australia, where I've been touring. Obviously trying to get back to playing music. I mean, some people obviously view as maybe a little bit pathetic, certainly a little trite after what they consider, you know, to be something important, as I do consider important. But they must understand that music to me is critically important for the good of my soul, let alone anything else. Band-Aid is something that I have to do. Music is something I want to do.
Okay, well, Bob Geldof, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Bob Geldof has been my guest. He organized Band-Aid and Live Aid and is also a composer, songwriter, singer. His new book, Is That It, is an autobiography that's just been published in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Dr. Robert Thurman. He's the founder of the American Institute for Buddhist Studies, who was the first American to be ordained a Tibetan Buddhist monk by the Dalai Lama. I hope you can join us. This is Bob Geldof from his recent solo album. All is calm and all is quiet. Close your eyes, sleep tonight. This is the wild is coming. All is quiet. Close your eyes, sleep tonight. This is the wild is coming.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, our rock critic Ken Tucker tells about late nights at punk clubs and stadium concerts. It's another in our continuing series of interviews with Fresh Air's contributors. Also, Ken reviews the music of British pop vocalist Rick Astley and his sister Virginia. Rick Astley's top English hit, Never Gonna Give You Up, is creeping up the American pop charts. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Unbearable Lightness of Being, based on the 1984 novel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. President Reagan's longtime friend and political advisor, Lynn Nofziger, was found guilty today on 3 counts of illegal lobbying. The jury deliberated just under 7 hours in the case. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
Nofziger is the first person to stand trial and be convicted under the ethics law. The jury found him guilty of illegally lobbying his former colleagues at the White House on behalf of 3 clients of the firm he started after he left his White House position in 1982. Those clients were the WETTEC Corporation, a maritime union, and the Fairchild Corporation. Nofziger was acquitted on a 4th count, which also involved WETTEC. Outside the courthouse, Nofziger, who was known as the man at the White House who helped the president fulfill campaign promises, said he was disappointed with the verdict.
I seem to have been found guilty of trying to get this administration to do what it promised to do. And I can tell you we're going to appeal. And I think that we're going to win that appeal.
Nofziger's attorneys say they will challenge the statute under which he was convicted. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
The third and last white teenager convicted in the death of a black man in the Howard Beach section of Queens was sentenced to prison today. Jason Ladone was sentenced to a total of 5 to 15 years on charges of manslaughter and assault. Ladone was convicted in December, along with 2 co-defendants, in the death of Michael Griffith, who was chased by a gang of white youths onto a busy highway and was struck by a car. Griffith died of his injuries. Ladone was sentenced to prison today despite a public courtroom apology to Michael Griffith's mother.
I would like to take this opportunity to say publicly, I'm sorry, Mrs. Griffith, for your senseless loss. I'm sorry, Mom and Dad, that your lives and hopes have been so violently turned around.
Griffith's mother said she hoped Ladone was speaking from his heart and not just his lips. Ladone received the lightest sentence of the 3 teenagers convicted in the killing. New York Governor Mario Cuomo met for more than 3 hours today with representatives of a black teenager who says she was assaulted last year by 6 white men. Tawana Brawley's attorneys say they will encourage her to cooperate with a special prosecutor appointed to investigate the case. A Cuban-American convicted of money laundering told a Senate subcommittee today that he arranged for profits from drug smuggling to go to the Nicaraguan Contras. He made the charge during hearings into the alleged illicit activities of Panama's military leader General Manuel Noriega. NPR's John Dingus reports.
Jan Rodriguez said he first got into the money laundering business to work with anti-Castro organizations in Miami. His main client, however, was the Medellin drug cartel of Colombia. He said he laundered up to $200 million a month in Panama under an arrangement he worked out personally with General Noriega. He also testified that he worked with the Contras supply network and delivered drug money to the Contras through 2 front organizations. Under questioning, he said the Contra supply operatives he worked with knew the money came from drug trafficking. Senator John Kerry, who is chairing the hearings, did not press Rodriguez for more details and said later hearings would probe the allegations. This is John Dingus in Washington.
Retail sales rose 0.5% last month. The Commerce Department reported today that retail establishments sold $128 billion worth of goods in January, the highest level since last August. Much of the strength in January came from auto sales, which climbed more than 1.5%. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed fractionally lower at 1961.54. Advances led declines 8-7 in active trading of 200 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange lost 5 cents. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. American rockers like Bruce Springsteen and John Cougar Mellencamp have reputations as topical songwriters. Rock critic Ken Tucker says that in contrast, the biggest hits in England these days are romantic, intentionally irrelevant songs by acts like Curiosity Killed the Cat, Mel and Tim, and this young man, Rick Astley.
The hottest song in pop music right now is that one, Never Gonna Give You Up, by Rick Astley, a 21-year-old from Manchester, England. The song has hit number one throughout most of Europe and just entered the top 10 here. Rick Astley is a red-haired, dewy-eyed little runt of a fellow with this booming crooner's voice. Seeing him perform in his music videos is like watching Woody Allen lip-sync to Engelbert Humperdinck. Astley's debut album suggests that he's a smart maker of the 80s version of disco music. Every song has a pumping beat and stark rhythm, and Astley emotes dramatically, trying to infuse slight songs with great romantic import. When he's working at the top of his form, he can be pretty impressive, as he is here on It Will Take a Strong, Strong Man.
My heart's been hurting when I see you flirting every night out on the floor. I keep thinking maybe tomorrow you'll grow to love me more. But when
Rick Astley's songs are produced by the team of Mike Stock, Matt Aitken, and Pete Waterman. Stock, Aitken, Waterman, or SAW as they call themselves, are the hottest production team in pop these days. Working with a stable of young acts like Samantha Fox, Bananarama, and Mel and Tim, the SAW team whips up smooth, sweet confections. They contrast sharply with other more aggressive English pop stars like the Pet Shop Boys and a hot new act called Johnny Hates Jazz. Rick Astley's American record company, RCA, is promoting him with the ad line, "The voice recognizable after just one listen." Clearly, it doesn't matter that this distinctive voice isn't saying anything special. It's the surface sound that's all important. By coincidence, Rick Astley's sister Virginia has also just released an album called Hope in a Darkened Heart. Virginia Astley has been in the biz longer than Little Brother. She's been releasing albums in England for a decade, but this is her first American record. Virginia's music is much more dreamy and self-consciously literary, part of a wholly different tradition.
Should you think of it, please know this as a thought. that's quite enough of that. Virginia Astley's record company actually compares her to Emily Dickinson, which I guess is supposed to convey her aspirations to formal poetry and her sensitive nature. The more realistic comparison is to early period Joni Mitchell, but even then, Virginia hasn't come up with melodies that carry you past the overwrought versifying the way Joni Mitchell always did. Even though his music is more cynical and lightweight, Brother Rick is the more intriguing music maker. He dedicates the final song on his album to Nat King Cole, whose ballad style he apparently hopes to emulate. Invoking Nat King Cole is a cool gesture, a good example of the way it's hip to be square in pop music these days. By that standard, Rick Astley is the squarest, hippest guy around.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Rick Astley's debut album is called Whenever You Need Somebody.
When I fall in love, it will be forever, or I'll never fall in love. In a restless world like this is, love is ended before it's begun, and too many moonlight kisses.
You're listening to Fresh Air. Question: how could you recognize rock critic Ken Tucker at a stadium concert? Answer: he's the one reading a book. Reviewing stadium concerts was never what Ken liked best about being a rock critic. Today we find out more about Ken as part of our continuing series of interviews with Fresh Air contributors. I wanted to know what the first rock record was that he liked well enough to buy.
It was the Beach Boys' The Sloop John B. I don't know why. It had nothing to do with my life. I think the fact that this boat, it took me, weeks to even figure out it was a boat. That's probably what it was. It was sort of like the I Am the Walrus for me. I had to try and figure out the lyric. But I like the harmonies. I like the Beach Boys. I don't know. It's, in retrospect, it seems like rather a bland choice. But that was I can remember the little jacket, the picture of the Beach Boys looking very solemn on the little sleeve of the 45 of Sloop John B.
Did you have a lot of odd jobs so you can make money to buy records?
No, I wasn't in fact allowed to buy records that much. My father was like very strict about this growing passion. I could buy like one record a week or a month or something. I remember suffering terribly under these constraints for some reason in retrospect.
So if you weren't allowed to buy records, you probably listened to the radio a lot.
That's right. Yeah, the radio was really it. I remember having a radio that was much, we didn't in those days have Walkman, but I remember having a small portable radio that I would literally take to bed with me and fall asleep listening to, sort of pressed up against my ear. And it was like everything from, I grew up in Connecticut, so I got all these New York stations. So I'd listen to Cousin Brucey and WMCA Good Guys on the one hand, and then sort of switch over to WOR and catch Gene Shepherd, and that sort of really liking radio a lot.
Was rock and roll always a part of your life, or did you discover it at some age?
I think I discovered it because it really wasn't sort of part of the atmosphere of my household. I never went to a rock concert until I was doing it professionally, believe it or not.
Wow.
It just was one of those things where between money and discipline, I just didn't go. So I think that was one reason it became such a passion for me when I got to about college age, was suddenly I was out of the house. I could do what I wanted to. So it was even more of a sort of secret passion.
Since this was your great escape going to college and you finally could buy records and go to concerts, no parental restrictions, you had access to the city, did you really go crazy for a while?
I led this incredibly dissolute existence. I was like down in Washington Square Park lying on the stone benches sleeping. No, not at all. In fact, at the beginning of my college life, it was just the opposite. I was entering some awful teenage arty phase. And what I was really doing was writing poetry. And so
there used to be a lot of this that went around.
That's right. And so what I wanted to do, my idea, I remember at the time, was not so much rock and roll in entering the city, but was that I was going to go emulate Frank O'Hara and John Ashbery and all these poets that I admired so much. But fortunately, sort of the times exactly coincided in a peculiar way with my interests, because that was the same time that people like Patti Smith, who was at that time a poet, was setting her poetry to music, suddenly had Lenny Kaye beside her strumming an electric guitar. So in a funny way, it led me back into rock and roll.
When you were starting to write about rock, this was in the 70s?
Mm-hmm.
Mid-70s?
That's right.
So it was more or less around the time when the punk scene was developing in New York.
Yeah.
You'd mentioned Patti Smith. Did you cover that a lot? Did you go to the clubs a lot?
Yeah, that was really a time when I really started. As a professional critic, you tend to be sent to the big acts, so that I would go to Madison Square Garden and see major acts if I got an assignment. But then the punk scene was something you pursued on your own, so it became even more exciting to go down to the Village to CBGBs and to small clubs and see Television and the Ramones and Blondie and all those bands that were just coming up, and see Talking Heads and David Byrne being even more awkward looking than he is now, if that can be believed, up on stage. And that really was exciting. And it was something that was sort of all around you at the time. It was something that everybody was talking about, and it was something you wanted to be in on the ground floor of. So that was a real exciting period.
How did you come to see the role of rock critic?
Well, I came to see it as a sort of bridge to the reader in terms of providing not only a consumer guide service, which you did have to say, you know, whether you should buy this record or not, but also providing some sort of sense of history, some sort of sense of context, and making it as lively and immediate as possible. I didn't see this sort of I think now rock criticism is a lot of consumer guide service, that most of it is. Buy this record, don't buy that one. And I think it's gotten to a point where it's sort of the Siskel and Ebert influence that's extended into rock and roll.
In the later part of the 70s, you moved to Los Angeles to write for the Los Angeles Herald Examiner. You were the rock critic there. And that was about the time that the hardcore bands were performing in Los Angeles.
That's right.
What kind of scene were you covering in Los Angeles? Did you go to those clubs at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was also a big... Los Angeles was such a city of contrasts that on the one hand, it was the center of the music industry, I think even more so than New York, although lots of record companies are based on both coasts. Los Angeles is such a showbiz town, having both the movie industry and the rock and roll industry there. And so the big acts were the very biggest, glitziest, showiest acts imagine. And this ended up breeding at the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, this incredibly bitter, turned in on itself rock scene that was full of people who wanted to make themselves as ugly as possible, as obnoxious as possible, as violent as possible. The standard idea for most of these acts was to scare the wits out of any major label A&R man that could possibly come to scout them. And a lot of these bands accepted it almost as like an artistic statement, that we'll make our statement for 6 months and we'll disband. We're not in it for record company contracts and royalties. We're in it to make a point and then disappear.
When you were going to those clubs and there was a slam dancing, which people would knock into each other and people would say, be spitting onto the performers on stage,
yeah,
or throwing things onto stage, how did you feel? Because you weren't part of that part of the scene or anything.
No, I would spit verbally through my writing, through the cutting edge of my prose is how I spit. But I could understand the impulse. These guys didn't have access that I had.
In the early 1980s, you moved to Philadelphia to write about rock for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And at the Inquirer, you ended up going to a lot of stadium concerts.
That's right. Yeah, I think the 80s saw that sort of, rock as big showbiz. It was a time when I began to feel sort of disaffected from that sort of stadium mentality. Even something like Live Aid, a huge phenomenon like that, I thought did a disservice to the musicians in the sense of the concerts being so huge, so massive, the bills of acts so large that each act could only perform, say, two or three songs and they were off the stage. It certainly as a philanthropic gesture, it was very nice, but as an artistic event, I thought it was really lacking in something.
You, fairly recently, within the past year, you transferred at the Enquirer from writing about rock to mm-hmm. writing about television.
Mm-hmm.
Had you gotten alienated from newspaper rock criticism?
Yeah, to a great extent, that's true. I think that in general, newspapers around the country are much more tied in these days to the idea of let's get the big star interview. I think in general that kind of that USA Todayization of newspapers of let's have the biggest names, let's write short stories, let's make everything positive. Everything has to be positive instead of providing some real sense of proportion that I just find very frustrating in a lot of ways.
You had spent so much of your adult life writing about rock for newspapers. Did it take you a long time to really admit to yourself that you not only wanted to make a change, but that you were really going to try to do it?
Yeah, I think so, although I'd sort of been prepared for it, and I think in moving over to television, it was another pop culture form that I felt very comfortable with.
Do you worry that when your children grow up that, oh, God, they might have bad taste in music?
Yes, I do. to some extent, I hope they like not necessarily what I like, but that they take an interest in it enough to sort of separate the junk from the good stuff on whatever sort of level of taste that they develop. My biggest fear is that they'll end up liking a kind of music that I know very little about. That they'll suddenly become Mozart freaks, and I'll have to sort of do a lot of hasty catching up. That's about the only fear I have at this point.
Well, Ken, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Fresh Air rock critic Ken Tucker.
We come on this sloop, John B. My grandfather and me. Around Nassau Town we did roam. Drinking all night. Got into a fight. Well, I feel so broken, I wanna go home.
This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, today there was a verdict in the influence peddling trial of former White House aide Lynn Nofziger. He's guilty on three counts, but he will appeal, and we'll have that story. Also, congressional hearings into Panama's involvement in the drug trade continue, and tonight, along with that story, we'll also have a report on the Southern Command, or South CAM. That's 10,000 American troops now stationed in Panama, and the U.S. forces are there not only to protect the canal, but also to gather intelligence in Central America and to develop strategies to deal with insurgent movements there.
Well, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of The Unbearable Lightness of Being, based on the 1984 novel by exiled Czech writer Milan Kundera. Kundera's other novels include The Book of Laughter and Forgetting and The Joke.
It seemed an almost impossible task. How could anyone manage to make a film version of Milan Kundera's novel The Unbearable Lightness of Being? The answer, I'm afraid, is not very well. Philip Kaufman's three-hour movie turns out to be absorbing and thoughtful, even painstaking, but also strangely lifeless. Kaufman is the director who gave us such marvelous movies as The Right Stuff and Invasion of the Body Snatchers. But here he's made the mistake so many directors make when they adapt a novel they adore. He's submerged his own exuberant sensibility, the better to accommodate what he takes to be Kundera's. Stern, ravaged, intellectual, deep. The result is a real oddity, an American epic with the icebox aroma of an East European art film. We watch Tomasz, a brilliant but wildly promiscuous neurosurgeon, played by Daniel Day-Lewis, fall in love with an unsophisticated provincial girl named Teresa, played by Juliette Binoche. Much to everyone's surprise, he marries her, which, however, doesn't dent his philandering.
I can't stand it. I tried harder. I just can't. Take me to them. Don't leave me alone.
Teresa, calm down. Stop talking. Try to sleep. You need some sleep now.
I don't want to sleep. I don't want to sleep.
Hello. Yes.
That phone call bears bad tidings. You see, this is 1968 in Prague, the year of socialism with a human face. But it was also the year of the Soviet invasion that overnight transformed Czechoslovakia into one of the most repressed nations in Europe. Tomáš and Terezia flee to Switzerland, but though Tomáš flourishes there, Terezia pines. Finally, she returns to Prague, leaving Tomáš a note that says, "I can't bear this lightness, this freedom. I'm going back to the country of the weak." Tomáš finds he can't bear lightness and freedom either, not without her. He too returns to Czechoslovakia, where life is now, believe me, plenty heavy. The screenwriter, Jean-Claude Carrière, has said that what he needed to get across on the screen was the power of Tomáš and Terezia's love. But that's just what's missing from the film. And no wonder. Kundera approaches his characters not through what they say and do, but through the little essays he can write about them. And any movie maker who thinks it's tough to capture a fictional character's internal stirrings ought to try capturing an author's. The screenplay throws out oblique references to lightness and weight and kitsch and other Kundera themes, but most of the time it just flounders. What seems to have happened here is that Kaufman considered his usual style, which is jumpy, energetic, all-American, inappropriate, his own lightness unbearable. In tackling the woes of Eastern Europe, he's tried to mimic Eastern European heaviness. If only he'd learned from Kundera's books, which work not because of their weight, but because of their ironic lightness. Or rather, because of the magisterial balance he finds between the two.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with computer animator Steven Siegel. Where most computer animation is composed on large and complex processors, Siegel often works on his home terminal. His work is featured in the current Computer Animation Festival. Also, Brazilian guitarist Orlando Haddad plays a couple of songs popular during Carnival, the Brazilian holiday that precedes Lent. And Ken Tucker reviews the home video release of The Shadow of the Thin Man, the last of the five Thin Man movies. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.